You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There was a time when mass media was a gold mine, but the new realities of the internet and our shifting consumer preferences are putting many of the most popular publications into jeopardy and forcing almost every advertiser to rethink their business strategy. Bob Garfield, the co-host of NPR's On the Media, has been following the growing confusion over how to sell products to the public for over two decades through his ad criticism column at Advertising Age, and now he has put the broken pieces together in a book called The Chaos Scenario: Amid the Ruins of Mass Media, The Choice for Business is Stark, Listen or Perish. It's published by Steelstra Publishing and brings Bob Garfield to our show today. Thanks for joining us.
Lenny, thank you for having me.
And Bob, I almost mispronounced this publishing company, a brand new publishing company?
Yeah, that's actually part of the story. It's called Steelstra Publishing. He is my partner, Greg Steelstra, who was the marketing genius behind a book very unlike this one called The Purpose-Driven Life, Rick Warren's pastoral book that sold 30 million copies.
And does this mean that you'll be able
to... I have no such expectations.
So you don't expect to be delivering any prayers at the next inauguration?
I'm available if the president, whoever that should be, needs me. I've got it penciled in, no ink just yet.
You say that you recognize the problems that we're talking about before they happened. Were you the only one?
No, I wasn't the only one. In fact, Procter & Gamble, the chairman of Procter & Gamble, began picking up the soundings maybe a dozen years before I did. But I might have been the first person to just look at all the evidence about starting about 5 years ago and connecting the dots. And when I connected the dots, I saw it wasn't a bear or a circus clown. It was a straight downward or near, let's say, a very steep trajectory downward for all of mass media. And, of course, because marketing has, for the last almost 400 years, had a completely symbiotic relationship with mass media, a downward trajectory for mass marketing as well. I saw a nightmare coming. The nightmare has since begun, and it's going to get a lot worse.
And so few people were willing to listen because there's a problem of denial at major companies in media and marketing, a natural tendency to assume that you'll always be doing business in the way that you've done it for so many years?
Yeah, some of it's denial. Some of it is clinging desperately to the status quo. And because, you know, let's face it, the people who run these institutions are extremely well-compensated men and women, mostly men, who have a real stake in nothing too disorderly happening, you know, at least until they're in retirement. So, and then just hubris. I mean, the notion that, well, this has been a mutually sustaining yin and yang since Elizabethan times. It's preposterous to think that somehow network TV and newspapers and magazines as an advertising medium are just going to, you know, disappear from the face of the earth. But in fact, that's exactly what's happening.
You quote Sir Martin Sorrell, the WPP Group's chairman, a number of times for his position on new media. What did he say?
Well, he said that the internet is just a new channel for communications, much like television and radio in their day were new channels. And all the advertising industry needs to do is adapt to a new channel, and nothing old will be lost, and we'll only have new opportunities. That is exactly wrong. This is a digital revolution that we are in the midst of, and I do not use the word revolution lightly. I mean, this isn't some news magazine cover headline. It's not a PowerPoint slide. It's going to be a real revolution with genuine dislocation. Literally millions of people losing their livelihoods. Now, there will be some advantages on the other end of it when the chaos begins to subside. But for the moment, this is kind of the equivalent of the Industrial Revolution. And people like you and me are cobblers who are getting by for the moment. But a whole new way of producing shoes is coming down the line, and it bodes poorly for us.
So do you think it'll hold out until my retirement at least?
Well, it depends on how much past 65 you're going to go.
you've called your book The Chaos Scenario, and you've already used the word chaos once. We're talking about serious dislocations then.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, this is no joke. We are talking about the ends of industries that have, you know, not only employed millions of people for centuries, almost four of them, but which we all of us depend on and believe as a, you know, kind of a birthright, that, you know, we shall have new episodes of Lost and nobody's going to take them from us. We shall have a robust local daily newspaper and 7 or 15 local radio stations and at least 3 network affiliate TV stations, because that's the way it's always been, and it's been fantastic.
But Bob,
we had to put up with some annoying advertising along the way, but it's a birthright. But of course, it isn't.
As long as people continue to watch Lost and American Idol, why is there a problem?
That is the question, and there's kind of 3 answers. First is that partly because of the internet and many other entertainment options, the audience, although it grows, for example, for television, the television audience in the United States has grown over the last few years. It is extremely fragmented among network TV, the 100 or some regular cable channels, the hundreds more digital channels, Guitar Hero, World of Warcraft, internet porn, and you name it. And the network shows get much, much smaller audiences than they did even 10 years ago. Curiously, even though the audiences have shrunk, the networks have actually earned more money per eyeball, because this is the last remaining mass audience, and they've been able to kind of gouge advertisers for extra, you know, for a premium, because this is last chance gas before Death Valley, and you may only reach 12 million people with your network ad buy compared to the 30 million you might have reached 15 years ago, but where else are you going to reach 12 million people? And they've actually, you know, squeezed more out of advertisers. But at some point, the critical mass is lost. And if you're only drawing 6 million people, say, to a network show, which happens for most programs, you can't afford to make any more. You can't afford to make network dramas with or sitcoms even with an audience of $6 or $7 or $8 million, which is why we have seen this vast proliferation of, you know, Dancing with the Former Stars or whatever. And
I'm sure it's the reason that an ad during the Super Bowl costs so much, because at least in that case, people can predict how many millions will be watching at the same time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in the meantime, with the, you know, as the audiences fragment and get smaller and smaller for any given network and any given program, of course, the advertisers begin to flee, which leaves the networks with still less money. So they're producing even junkier programs, which leads to more audience exodus, which leads, and so forth and so on. And it's a spiraling vortex of ruin. And certainly nobody that I know of has come up with a solution for it.
My guest is Bob Garfield, and his book is called The Chaos Scenario: Amid the Ruins of Mass Media, The Choice for Business is Stark. Listen or Perish. And we'll get into that whole listen in a little while. The book is published by Steelstrip Publishing. Well, so you're talking about the kinds of fragmentation that have led to real problems for advertisers. Advertisers don't really want to buy ads on stations where on one station when there are so many other competing stations. But what about the economic downturn? Doesn't that also always affect the amount of advertising that is going to be put in, whether there are just 3 major networks or whether there are 300 different channels to choose from?
Yeah, this has been what has come to be known as a perfect storm. I mean, you have the structural changes in the industry that are directly related to the digital revolution. Then you have this historic recession which in every case, even in the very heyday of network television and newspapers and magazines, would cause advertisers to pull back and, you know, money leaves the system and so forth. And I suspect that as sometime in the middle of 2010, as the recession at least flattens out and we get towards some nominal amount of growth in the economy, advertisers will begin to come back into places that they had fled, but not to the degree that they were in before. And all of the structural problems that related to chaos will continue to pile up. And I would say there will be a bump, a positive bump at the end of the recession, and then the downward curve will resume.
Well, I used to be in the business of selling records on television, and that business kind of went under other than Time Life. But now we're seeing a resurgence of that sort of thing, these humbler, sometimes unintentionally funny commercials with people screaming at us. And if you order now, you also get thrown in some cubic zirconia earrings or whatever. Are they making money?
Yes, some of them are. I'd be happy to talk to you about the Billy Mays, God rest his hollering soul, genre.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine anybody responding to him.
Well, you know, that's almost an entirely different universe. It is advertising purchased at the very lowest rates in the middle of the night at stations that nobody's watching, right?
Well, it's buying remnant time. We used to buy 2 minutes to sell Boxcar Willie and Slim Whitman and Roger Whittaker and all those other records and the slicers and the dicers. We did very well. But then because of cable, the audience got too diluted, and OR and PIX and stations like that went network. It became impossible to run those ads anymore. And now we're seeing them back.
I wonder if Zamfir will be back.
we can
Zamfir
only hope.
And his magical pan flute. From your lips to God's ears. But that's a very specialized category, and it's kind of the serendipitous approach to marketing, and that is, you know, there is nobody, absolutely nobody, who is thinking during the course of the day, I wish I had more Slim Whitman in my record collection, you know? But it's 3:30 in the morning. You're a little bleary-eyed. You're watching probably a rerun of Petticoat Junction, one of the worst episodes. And along comes Slim Whitman, and for whatever reason, you go, you know, that's kind of a quirky, old-time country and western sound, and I kind of like that. And it's only $9.99, shipping and handling not included.
And not available in stores.
And it's not available in stores. Act now. And if you do, you will get, you know, whatever, the Boxcar Willie treasury as well. And it looks so fantastic in your compromised state. That you get out your credit card.
Well, before all of this, we had the threat of TiVo and DVRs and people skipping through commercials. Has that really hurt?
It has hurt, and that's the second element of chaos. There's basically three elements. One is the fragmentation, which takes the critical mass away from media who have been charging advertisers, you know, a lot for large audiences. The second is ad avoidance. You know, there's some ads we all love. You know, everybody loved Clara Peller, Where's the Beef? Everybody loved the fast-talking man for Federal Express and the old Volkswagen ads and Benson and Hedges. And you know, there's probably hundreds in our, you know, somewhere in our memory banks of ads that really we sort of cherish. And every year at Madison Avenue, you know, they have a parade and Tony the Tiger goes down in a, you know, in the back of a limousine and waves to the crowd, and everybody goes, oh, it's Tony the Tiger. And so we sometimes are tricked into believing that we actually like ads. Madison Avenue certainly believes that we hold a dear soft spot in our heart, but the fact is all the evidence goes the other way. People resent advertising. They resent more than anything else its intrusiveness. It always interrupts what you would prefer to be doing. And the statistics have always shown that if people could avoid ads, they would. Well, along comes the DVR, and along comes the computer, And with the DVR, you can TiVo right past the ads, and 70% of the people who own a DVR do exactly that. And with the internet, you know, there's a banner ad, you can click on it or not. 98% of the time, people do not click on it because why would they? Why would you interrupt the reason you're on a given page to go to some advertiser's website to be marketed to? And by the way, of that 2%, you know, probably at least half of that is attributable to click fraud or mouse error. So an infinitesimal portion of the public is interested enough in a given online banner ad to go there. So that's ad avoidance. People don't want to be advertised to, at least not if it isn't in the time and place of their own choosing.
Mike,
so that's number two.
Well, Bob, we have to take a little break, and we'll come back to number three. And we'll go into the death of newspapers and magazines as well as we continue this conversation with Bob Garfield, who has worked for Advertising Age for 24 years, also co-host of our own NPR show on the media, and a founding contributor to the Watchdog blog of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. He has contributed to many publications, and now there's this book, The Chaos Scenario, Amid the Ruins of Mass Media, The Choice for Businesses Stark, Listen or Perish. It is published by Steelstra Publishing. Stay with us for more. We're back with Bob Garfield talking about his book, The Chaos Scenario, Amid the Ruins of Mass Media, The Choice for Business is Stark, Listen or Perish. It's published by Steelstra Publishing. And Bob, let's talk about newspapers and magazines. The reason usually given for their problems now is the internet. Is that fair? Is that it?
Yeah. it's mainly it. I mean, some people talk about the mistrust of the media and the content and all that. But no, fundamentally, the problem is that people are reading newspapers not on newsprint, but online, increasingly online. Oh, their audiences have expanded vastly, but newspapers cannot fetch the same prices to reach their audiences online that they were able to fetch in the old-fashioned off-the-presses broadsheets and tabloids.
And people like me,
it's dollars and cents.
And people like me who prefer to have the thing in my hand and also like the idea that through peripheral vision I notice an article I might not have read otherwise that really turns out to be the more interesting thing, we're dying off?
Yeah, well, I mean, literally, we're dying off. I read the newspaper the same way you do, and I mean, to me, the A section of the New York Times is Christmas every day because, you know, I'm going one page to the next and I find things that I wasn't looking for but, you know, delight me or interest me or what have you that I never would have found by sort of drilling down in the way that you do when you read a newspaper online. And I mean, I love that experience and it's an important part of my life, but the younger generation doesn't do it that way, and you know, there aren't enough of us to buy actual print subscriptions. Even if the advertisers were willing, there aren't enough of us to sustain the whole industry.
Bob from Brooklyn called in to ask, there seem to be a large number of foreign language newspapers in my area. Can the newspaper industry really be declining? That part seems to be growing.
It's not. It's happening a little more slowly, but for example, in Europe, the industry is undergoing approximately the same pressures it's undergoing here. Your niche publications have better chances than general interest publications. And when I say niche, I mean either yachting magazine or one that's aimed at the Hungarian diaspora. The idea of interest groups and serving them with news and information has not disappeared, but the ability to do it profitably on print editions is diminishing with every day.
And then people talk about how much newspapers can charge for the internet service. Every attempt to charge has been a disaster. And I know if I were an advertiser, yeah, as you said earlier, I'd be very reluctant to be in an internet version of a newspaper because people are not going to look at my ad the same way that they will if they're turning pages and there in big type is the word sale.
Exactly. So the idea of charging for content, there's, you know, the New York Times now has millions more daily readers than it did in its absolute heyday as a merely print publication. But these readers are impossible to monetize because, in fact, I'm sorry, I have to give you the number three because it's very important. The number three reason it's all going to seed is the simple law of supply and demand. The internet is a almost literally infinite resource of content, and in a market of infinity, obviously the supply vastly exponentially outstrips the demand, and for that reason, publishers of even the most high quality content online are in competition with, you know, Brittany the 14-year-old who has a blog and is on Google AdSense. And by the simple law of supply and demand, advertisers, and putting aside the question of ad avoidance, advertisers simply are not paying for internet ad space what they paid in print. And that, therefore, the New York Times and others just can't make enough money online to support their vast infrastructures.
And can't they charge?
For the paywall. Well, the paywall is another problem. I mean, advertisers... publishers made a decision, almost as one 10 years ago, that their business model would be an advertiser-supported one. It supported, after all the other media, going back to Elizabethan days. Why wouldn't it work on the internet? Well, they made a gigantic, colossal blunder. They believed that a larger audience would give them more eyeballs and therefore more advertising revenue. But they just didn't account for how much the oversupply would suppress the amount they can fetch for an ad. And they get pennies on the dollar compared to what they got in their print newspapers. And now they realize they can never sustain their vast news organizations with advertising revenue strictly from online. And now they're trying to put the genie back in the bottle and say, we're going to set up paywalls. Well, sorry, it's too late. We have all come to expect... anything we want to access at a mouse click for free. And having been given it all for free for so long, nobody is much of a mind to start paying. And they're facing a huge behavioral and cultural and economic hurdle trying to get money from people who they've served for nothing for a decade.
My guess is Bob Garfield, his book, The Chaos Scenario, Amid the Ruins of Mass Media, The Choice for Business is Stark. Listen or Perish. It's published by Steelstra Publishing. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I want to get to some of the solutions, but just a few more of the problems. Magazines also going out of business. We've seen Portfolio go under just recently, Domino Home. Are the bigger ones, like the New Yorker, Time, Newsweek, People, also in danger?
Sure, they're all in danger. I'll go farther. I believe they're doomed. Condé Nast, to my way of thinking, is the best, highest quality magazine publisher in the United States. I mean, they have incredible titles. And, they were down, I think, 37% in the first quarter on pages, down from a catastrophic first quarter of 2008. And it's that way across... Meredith, Hearst, everybody is on the mat, and there's their online products again. While they have some audience, just do not generate enough revenue to keep the lights on.
What about television shows online? There are a few players you can use, like Hulu. Do those players bring in ad revenue?
They actually fetch more money per thousand than even the ads on TV, which would sound good, except for two things. One, they have many fewer ads in a given half hour of programming. It would be 8 minutes worth of advertising on TV, and it might be only 90 seconds in a Hulu version. Secondly, of course, if you're watching it on Hulu, you're not watching it on TV, which diminishes the audience on the broadcast version further. Thirdly, and this is very important, Hulu comes to you online through your broadband connection. Well, who provides your broadband connection? Most likely your cable company. So you are now using your broadband to watch the programming that you used to pay your cable company for. Well, we are already beginning to see a phenomenon, which is only going to rapidly escalate, of people canceling their cable subscriptions and using their broadband connections to get all the programming they want for free. So they used to pay, you know, $140 a month for cable and $40 for a broadband. Now they're only paying $40 for the broadband. And they're using Hulu to watch TV. And by the way, they're watching it on their actual TVs. They don't have to watch it on their laptops. You can wirelessly connect to your TV and have a TV-like experience. And now suddenly the cable model is collapsing too. That's called over-the-top, and it's a big problem.
Some of the attempts at getting around all of this, like Quarter Life, have failed. What did they do wrong?
Well, they just didn't generate enough audience. I mean, they had a fantastic series, and they had quite a following online. But, you know, unfortunately for them, they took the same series to television, and they had on NBC for the TV debut of what had been, by internet terms, a successful program, the biggest flop in like 12 or 15 years of network TV debuts. I mean, it was immediately canceled on NBC. They put a few episodes, I believe, on Bravo, one of the cable networks, and then it quickly evaporated from broadcast TV. And, you know, it continues to generate interest online, but they don't have enough money to make new episodes. And believe me, the episodes that they did make were done, for pennies. The producers of that called in every favor they had in Hollywood, and there were plenty. And they got these very, very wonderful webisodes produced on the cheap, but they can't generate enough audience to sell enough advertising against to make more episodes. And that is it's quintessential. They are a perfect example of why the TV broadcast model is collapsing, because there's not enough dough coming in to create the shows going out.
What happened with Yahoo? Last year they resisted being bought by Microsoft. Now they've agreed to do it.
Yeah, they have
reality set in?
Reality set in. This is the biggest publisher, the most successful internet publisher in scale in terms of volume of audience and advertising. But they're subject to exactly the same law of supply and demand that the webisode show Quarter Life was and the New York Times Online. They just... The price of advertising on Yahoo is depressed by the glut of online inventory. And there's no solution for that problem. The head of sales at Yahoo said there's just too much advertising inventory out there. Not online, but everywhere. And there is no way that everybody can survive. So, you know, at a very minimum, even if my chaos scenario is not fully realized with the end of all media, we are certainly going to witness in the next 5 to 7 years a breathtaking consolidation in the number of players out there.
Has Google worked it out?
Yeah, sure. Google's got the tiger by the tail because they sell search advertising. And as long as they can keep this vast market share in the search business, they're in great shape because search obviously was a tool, an application that has changed human behavior on a grand scale. And it was always envisioned to them not only to be a search engine for the convenience of the peeps, but a way to send the most targeted advertising to the users. Because after all, if you're searching VCRs, they're more than happy to serve a VCR ad to you or 12 of them.
Well, let's get
and,
to... I'm sorry, we have very little
VCR
time.
VCR was a really bad example because they don't really...
We have very little time, Bob, and I want to get to the listen or perish part of your subtitle,
sure.
Your idea of listenomics, which also could have been a name for this book. What is listenomics? How can people listen or perish? I thought they were listening, and they just weren't figuring it out.
Yeah, the book would have been called Listenomics if it weren't for, Wikinomics and Sheikonomics and freaking Wikinomics.
Well, you could also have done...
I'm sorry, Freakonomics. It was... I got enomicked from the time I coined it to the time the book came out. Several other books had come out using the same kind of, coinage. But
you could use the listening point.
That would have been very good.
Mm-hmm. I know you don't like.
I'm not going to make a call.
I don't know. I know you don't agree with Malcolm Gladwell on the tipping point.
There's a few pages in the book that are devoted to sort of debunking the tipping point idea, but it does have to do with listenomics. And listenomics is simply this: in a digital world where everybody is connected, we are at the end of history in the sense that all of history has meant hierarchical structures, institutions, whether it's the church, whether it's government, the king, the media, Procter & Gamble, deciding what the message is, deciding the way things are going to be, and then the man dictates it to the hoi polloi, and the hoi polloi just take it. Hollywood decides what we're going to see. The Vatican decides what the liturgy is going to be. And Procter & Gamble decides just how many versions of Spring Fresh Tide they're going to be out there. But now, because of interconnectivity, we're not so much listening to institutions tell us what they want to tell us, because we're all talking among ourselves about them. And one of the ways this manifests itself is we do a lot of talking, trash talking about them. I myself started a website called Comcast Must Die, to shame the Comcast Corporation into building a customer service infrastructure that actually dealt with problems instead of exacerbated them. And they, in fact, had to kind of surrender. They threw in the towel and they said, we are now going to do ourselves what you did, Bob, in creating this third-party location for people to come vent their problems and get them solved. But it's not just problem resolution and dealing with complainers. The group formerly known as the audience is a collection of ideas, IQ, passions, the willingness to be an evangelist, all of the above. And it is but for institutions to start tapping into that vast force that has never been tappable in all of human history. And we're seeing this in so many ways. We're seeing it, for example, mybarackobama.com. Yeah, he did a lot of traditional stuff as a candidate, but the most successful aspect of his campaign was to get 20 million email addresses, to get 1 million volunteers working for him, all and raising I don't know how many hundreds of millions of dollars all online. By using the vast resources of digital connectivity to take the people and make them collaborators, stakeholders in whatever your institution happens to be. And this is changing everything. Government, art, even science. Science is now being done via crowdsourcing, where instead of a handful of geniuses in a laboratory, scientific problems are sent out to the whole world to get the best thinking, maybe from disciplines that ordinarily would not have been consulted. And this promise is just inestimably high. And mind you, there's going to be a lot of blood in the streets from the end of old media, but the capacity for institutions to thrive and prosper through all of this is actually going to dramatically increase once they get rid of the denial and once they don't just grudgingly embrace the idea that people are talking back, but they actually internalize and embrace the idea that the former audience is now a vast resource to be exploited for everybody's interest.
And we'll leave it on that optimistic note. Thank you so much for talking with us, Bob Garfield. the chaos scenario amid the ruins of mass media, the choice for business is stark, listen or perish, published by Steelstra Publishing. And Bob, thank you so much for talking with us. I look forward to hearing you again on the weekend on On the Media.
Thank you, Lenny. I really appreciate it.